Appeal Number 06-1088, Dystar Textile Farben v. C.H. Patrick Company. Mr. Jones, good morning. Welcome. Perhaps I should say welcome back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good to have you here. Please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Your Honors, we have addressed many issues in our briefs, maybe in fact too many issues in our briefs, so I will try to concentrate on just three this morning regarding the invalidity of this patent. And these three issues can be defined as being focused on the plain language of the prior art. We believe that that's what went wrong in this case, is that the prior art was incorrectly considered by the jury, and the plain language of that prior art was not sufficiently considered. The three issues are, number one, whether or not the Brochet patent itself, on its face, teaches the use of its indigo solution for dyeing. Number two,
even if it does it teach the exact concentrations in claims 2, 3, and 4?
No, Your Honor, we're not
concerned. So anticipation's off the table right off the bat, and then you've got to deal with a motivation to combine. What would motivate one to combine Brochet, which is not a patent dealing with dyeing anything, it's the creation of dye stuffs. As they point out, there was indeed things that taught away from the use of Brochet in dyeing.
Yes,
it seems to me like there's a big problem when you start combining Brochet with other pieces of prior art to get into the dyeing process at specific concentrations.
Well, Your Honor, in order to address that question, what we have to look at is the prior art that existed prior to Brochet. There was lots of prior art that talked about using leuco-indigo solutions mm-hmm. for dyeing. There are specifically, as we've set forth in our briefs, the 900 patent, which is a BASF patent, and the 978 patent, which is André Chamont's patent.
Mm-hmm.
Both those patents talk about using a leuco-indigo solution, not made by catalytic hydrogenation, but using a leuco-indigo solution in this very process. Then, in 1917, Brochet comes along. And you're right, he doesn't talk about textiles, he doesn't talk about cotton, but he does say that one of the two uses in the patent is to dilute immediately before dyeing. And Your Honor, whether you're using the Brochet patent or whether you're using the BIOS report leuco-indigo solution or whether you're using the 992 process, that what's talked about as the leuco-indigo solution 20%, of Dystar, those are all just different ways of making, or a different way of making the leuco-indigo solution. Regardless of what you start with, you still have to dilute it, and you actually dilute it before it's used. Now, they argue that their solution is different in the process because nobody dilutes it while it's sitting in the tank. Well, that's not what Brochet says, and that's not what prior art says. All the evidence at trial says that once the solution gets into the dye bath, it is diluted down to 1% or below. So whether you start with a 2% solution of Brochet, or whether you start with the 20% solution of the BIOS report, or whether you start with the solution that Dystar sold in 1992-93 at 20%, you're still diluting it immediately before use. And it's our position that that's exactly what the Brochet patent was talking about. And the reason that you would combine the Brochet patent with this pre-1917 prior art is exactly what their expert said were the reasons why the 992 patent was invented: to address concerns in the environment, so that impurities and salts were not put into the environment, and that's exactly what Brochet says, that there are no impurities, no salts in the catalytically hydrogenated solution, and it's economical, which is another aspect discussed in the Brochet patent.
What would you do with the secondary considerations? The buffalo color failure, the long-felt need, the skepticism of experts, things of that nature. In other words, there seems to be quite a bit of evidence, and you are fighting a jury verdict.
I understand, Your Honor. I'm probably fighting the highest burden that comes before this court because I've got clear and convincing evidence, and I've got substantial evidence. Yeah. I understand that.
Yeah.
I addressed
and there is evidence of secondary considerations in addition to the motivation.
There is some evidence, yes, Your Honor. But we addressed each one of those in our briefs, the ones that you mentioned. The long-felt need, Your Honor, the testimony as to long-felt need was that this was a special dye process in two dye houses in the world. That's the answer to the long-felt need. As far as commercial success, this was part of a package of dyes that this company sold to Avondale in the United States. And then finally, with respect to the buffalo color issue, they say that buffalo color went out of business because they didn't sell this product. That's not why buffalo color went out of business. The testimony in the case is that buffalo color went out of business because of infiltration from the Chinese, from Chinese-based indigo. And now with respect...
But don't we have to, in the context of a jury verdict, read it precisely the other way? We have to read this evidence, although there may be contrary evidence. Don't we have to accept the evidence as the jury would have accepted it?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, you do.
So how do we get past both the motivation to combine and the secondary considerations to reach an obviousness determination?
Well, two things, Your Honor. As I understand the law about objective considerations and secondary considerations, those are based on what happened in the real world. What are the circumstances in the real world? And I would urge that in this case, there is no better secondary consideration than what happened in the real world in the 1980s. Now, granted, this is not prior art under the U.S. patent laws, but in Brazil, my client, Mr. Ban, took the prior art that we are urging here in this case. He took his college textbook from the 1940s. He took the BIOS report itself, and he took some other information, and he put that together and developed the product himself. It was obvious to him that if you wanted to have a leuco-indigo solution, if you were going to put it directly into the dye bath, then you would use the leuco-indigo solution and you would go to the catalytically hydrogenated version, which is a better product than the old versions made from iron...
Alkali.
Yes, sir. Exactly. And that's what happened here. That is the real-world evidence in this case. Mr. Ban.
Independent invention.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. Independent invention.
But that doesn't mean it's obvious. It can be independently invented.
No, sir. You're exactly right. It does not mean that it's obvious, but what it does mean, what means that it is obvious, is that all of this information was around and there was a clear motivation to combine. Let me put that in context for you. The most telling testimony in this entire case, I believe, is found at appendix page 319 through 320. And that's where Mr. Schnitzer, their inventor, their technical expert, said the following four things. He said, in 1917, aqueous solutions of leuco-indigo made by catalytic hydrogenation were known. He said, number two, in 1917, dipping was known, which is one of the limitations of claims. He said, in 1917, skying was known. And then, probably most importantly, he said that in 1917, leuco-indigo solutions were known to be used for dyeing. At that point, it was merely an easy jump to combine the catalytically hydrogenated leuco-indigo solution into what was already known.
Are you saying that in the 1980s, as a matter of fact, your client, taking just the materials you mentioned, the scientific documents that you mentioned, without experimentation, was able to come up with this product?
Yes, Your Honor.
With no experimentation?
Well, It's a degree of experimentation, sure, but what he did...
I guess our case law says without undue experimentation.
Right, without undue experimentation. You know how he did it? And this is in the transcript. He took the BIOS report itself, and he followed that procedure to a T. And that is exactly how he produced the leuco-indigo solution in the late 1980s. That's how he produced the leuco-indigo solution that he was sued on in this case, according to the BIOS report itself.
And nothing more?
No, sir. He had some more. He had his knowledge of indigo chemistry from what he had learned in college. He obviously... And the way this whole thing was created by him is he had a lot of extra hydrogen at his plant. And so he had to come up with some means to use that hydrogen. He didn't just want to get rid of it. He wanted to do something with it. And so testimony is that somebody mentioned to him, hey, you can make indigo solutions using that hydrogen. And so that's exactly what he did. He went to the text, went to the BIOS report, and discovered how to do that.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to ask you, at 467 of the joint appendix, I guess Dystar's expert, Mr. Blackburn, is being questioned, and he's asked, why do you say that Dr. Brochet does not teach introducing it into a dye bath, meaning his product, leuco-indigo? He says, answer, he is not talking about dyeing, he is talking about making an intermediate chemical. He is not talking about the process for dyeing at all. What did you understand Mr. Blackburn to be asserting there when he referred to an intermediate chemical?
Yes, Your Honor. He was referring to this to one of the two uses in the Brochet patent. The Brochet patent at lines 65 through 70 talks about two ways its product can be used. One is to dilute it immediately before use, which we believe is dyeing. And the second is to make concentrated products for sale. And clearly...
In a paste or a cake form.
You could do that, or you could make a more concentrated solution.
Okay.
I mean, you could do that. And what happened, and this is disclosed by the Brochet paper, which is one argument that they make quite a bit of, the Brochet paper only discusses the use of indigo solutions as an intermediate. And we admit that. But, Your Honors, as I suggested in my brief, that's like saying a teacher on Monday talks about two subjects, and then on Tuesday, the teacher only mentions one of the two subjects. And their logic is that that means that the second subject taught on Monday was never taught.
You're down to 3 minutes. Do you want to save the time?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Enos, good morning. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank
nice
you.
To have you back.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
May it please the court. There was no inequitable conduct here. There was absolutely no evidence at trial that anyone at all had actual knowledge of any reference that was alleged to be concealed. Judge Cato's finding of no intent is the only finding he could possibly have made on this record. Accordingly, his grant of JMOL was correct. He did not abuse his discretion in granting JMOL of no inequitable conduct. An abuse of discretion, as this court recently recognized in Old Town Canoe, decided on May 9th, 2006.
Could you keep your voice up a little higher, please?
Yes. Abuse of discretion is the standard, as was reaffirmed by this court in Old Town Canoe, decided May 9th, 2006. Regarding inequitable conduct, what the appellants want is for this court to hold that it may be proper to rest inference upon inference by first inferring knowledge of a reference and then further inferring from that first inference an intent to deceive. Ignoring ample precedent of this court, they went so far as to tell Judge Cato that he need not find knowledge.
This is a most unusual argument in the sense that, as I heard it and recall it, Mr. Jones didn't argue the inequitable conduct point here orally. It's in his brief, of course, but he didn't argue it here orally. Normally, the response argument here responds to what's argued here orally, and the briefs duel it out on paper. So,
yes,
I'm not ruling you out of order, but I'm just observing that it's a little unusual for you to be addressing an issue that he didn't argue orally.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to start with what I considered was our major point. There was no error here. Brochet does not anticipate. The plain language.
We're talking obviousness.
No, I'm talking anticipation.
Yes, but he addressed obviousness. That's where we are.
Yeah, we're on obviousness.
Brochet teaches how to make a die. Vimmer teaches how to make a die. Chalmette teaches how to make a die.
BIOS teaches how to use it. Why can't you combine BIOS with all of those and with knowledge of skill in the art reach the same concentrations and get the invention?
BIOS teaches how to use it as an intermediate to make the other three products listed there. There is absolutely no teaching in BIOS to use that aqueous solution as a dye. Every reference submitted to the jury talked about using that aqueous solution.
But one of skill in the art would know that the purpose for indigo is to use it as a dye. That's not a difficult leap to make. So what is the evidence that we can rely upon to find that there was no motivation to combine these things, particularly when, according to Mr. Jones, they were combined by at least one person to arrive at the invention?
That's incorrect. What Mr. Jones said is those references were combined to make the leuco-indigo solution. This claim is not about a product. This claim is about a process. The 992 patent itself admits that this product is old. What no one thought of doing until DyStar was, well, BASF before DyStar, was to take that aqueous solution of leuco-indigo, which is unstable when exposed to air, and actually introduce it into a dye bath.
Yeah, well, why isn't it within the prior art knowledge that when something is unstable in its liquid form because it will oxidize detrimentally, that we just put it in a sealed container so it's not exposed to oxygen? Why wouldn't that be totally apparent immediately to any artisan in this field? And then one would deduce, now that we have it stored immune from oxygen, this instability is not a problem, and now we can just put it in a dye bath and use it without any intervening steps or vats or tanks.
There's an assumption that you would put it in a dye bath. None of the prior art talks about putting those solutions in a dye bath. They talk about
Brochet talks about its use
to dye. Wimmer and Chaumette, there are different ways to dye. Indigo has been used as a dye from time immemorial. And the principal way that it's been used...
You're going to use it to dye, you're going to put it in the dye bath.
First, you have to make a stock vat, Your Honor. In other words, you don't introduce it into the dye
bath.
You're
giving us steps which I perceive to be those that one of skill in the art would reach very axiomatically and quickly.
But if that were the case, why was it done for 80 years? No one did it. For 80 years.
Well, that isn't the question. The question is whether it's obvious from the prior art. It is an evidence of long-felt need that it wasn't done for a long period of time, but have you really addressed completely the evidence upon which the jury could have relied?
For obviousness, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, I believe that we have. In addition to what's in our brief, there's just no evidence. I mean, Wimmer, in 1939, a person of ordinary skill in the art, would have that paper.
Let me tell you something that troubles me about your evidence. Throughout the record, I see you saying, all this is old prior art. It wouldn't have been considered by someone of skill in the art. This is all... The judge at one point makes that comment that it's so old no one would have looked at it. Now, that's clearly not the law. Prior art is prior art. The age of it, in fact, the length of its age tends to lend more credibility to its use by one of skill in the art as general knowledge. But there are indications that there was a lot of misinformation flying around in the trial about the use of prior art and how it can be combined.
I disagree. Our expert, what this came down to was a battle of the experts.
You agree that the judge erred when upon saying, that's so old no one would have looked at it?
That statement went to intent, and in that respect, I do not agree that he erred. I agree that prior art is prior art. Now, the question is it analogous prior art? And we've said no. These references, every combination that they tried to rely upon for obviousness, is not analogous because it deals with making dies. If I make a pacemaker, and I say in my patent, I have a pacemaker, you can use it in heart surgery, does that convert my patent into a patent that a heart surgeon would want to read? They're two different fields. They're not
related. Well, that's what analogous art deals with, where the fields are different, but they're interconnected sufficiently that an artisan trying to solve a problem would look at both pools of knowledge.
And that's the point here.
I think it's a huge stretch to say that these references come from different arts and that those different arts are not analogous. I almost think it's the same art myself, but it certainly seems like it's analogous art.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. And one of the reasons that I would disagree is that a person of ordinary skill in this art is a person with a high school degree who can read and write and has about a year of experience. And such a person, there was testimony to the jury, simply would not read technical patents on how to make a die. They could care less. They want to know how to use the die.
But they're presumed to have that knowledge, right? Even if they would or wouldn't read them. This is another error that I see creeping into things. The prior art, nonetheless, is presumed to be available for combination, regardless of whether they are even capable of reading.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct if it's art in that area, in that field.
And all of this is dealing with Leuco indigo.
Well, no, Your Honor. Brochet, for example, deals with different classes of bad dyes. And some of those classes of bad dyes are stable. The Leuco derivatives are stable in atmosphere. And those are the sorts of bad dyes that he was talking about when he said you can dilute them before use. Other types of bad dyes, like indigo, are unstable in contact with the air. And those dyes are what he said you had to concentrate and make into a stable form before you could use them.
Let me ask you a different question. The opinion in disposing of these post-trial JMAL motions is exceedingly brief. It's
yes,
almost no opinion at all, I would say. Now, of course, obviousness in our case law is categorized as an issue of law, albeit dependent quite significantly on underlying Graham fact findings and so forth, as we all know.
Correct.
Now, despite the deference owed to the jury in terms of substantial evidence, isn't a trial judge on the issue of obviousness in the face of a jury verdict obliged to ultimately do a legal analysis of whether the facts as apparently found by the jury resolve the question of obviousness in a way that's legally correct? And if that is the obligation of this judge, how can we tell whether he carried it out or not, because he didn't say a word except not obvious?
Well, there's two parts to the answer. The first is...
So there were two questions.
Sorry. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure permit him to just let the judgment stand. He doesn't have to say anything.
It may be that there isn't a rule violation. On the other hand, I believe there's considerable case law that says that when an appellate court is confronted with a black box opinion that's utterly opaque, you can't tell what the judge thought, much less why, that we can vacate and remand. Why shouldn't we do so here?
Well, the judge did say, and he did listen to all of the evidence and evaluated
the credibility. But he didn't explain anything. All the things we're discussing here with Mr. Jones and with you and with one another and delving into all these references that we're naming, he never said a word about any of that.
That's
how
correct.
Can we tell what he made of any of that?
because he did say that the verdict was reasonable and was based upon substantial evidence in view of the credibility determinations. That's what he said.
Yeah, but that's not reviewable. How do we know whether it's reasonable?
Well, I mean, one aspect of that is that Judge Cato is very familiar with patent law. He's the judge who handled
Doesn't
Warner
make
Jenkinson.
Any difference. Whether a magistrate judge or a district judge has tried two patent cases or 2,000, we still have to have an opinion that supports meaningful review, and I'm questioning whether we have that here, and if we don't, why aren't we obligated to vacate and remand, whatever our view of the ultimate issue of obviousness might be?
Your Honor, if you have a jury verdict, there's no need for an opinion. I mean, that's the whole point of a jury trial. You turn it over to the jury.
Well, that might be true if there was no such a thing as a post-verdict JMAL motions, but there is.
There's no precedent, so far as I know, that says if somebody makes a JMAL verdict and the judge denies it, he has to write an opinion. And in fact, in Old Town Canoe, the judge's verdict of JMOL on no inequitable conduct was affirmed, and he made no findings. It was affirmed by this court. He made no findings. He said it was not shown to be an abuse of discretion. The art simply does not teach one of ordinary skill in the art of dyeing to take this solution of Brochet and use it. Even Brochet himself says you can't use it as
Where
a
does
dye.
He say that?
He says that in his article. His article says, I talked about all these
because it's unstable.
Elsewhere. Sorry?
Because it's unstable.
That's correct. It's unstable. And remember.
But that leads to the chief judge's question. Why then just seal it? Remove
it
from
work.
The office.
There was no evidence on that at trial. Maybe it doesn't work. We don't know. They didn't put evidence on that point into the record. Now, there is other evidence that this is not pertinent art. The jury had textbooks from 1910, from 1922, from 1933, and from 1953 that were directed to dying, to people who die. Not one of those textbooks referenced one of these references. A dyer would not consider these references. Just wouldn't. A dyer is interested in how to dye. And this patent is the first patent. It's the first time anyone introduced this into a dye bath. Mr. Jones was talking about a secret sale in Brazil, of secret making and sale in Brazil. That dyeing attempt failed. It failed. They say it's because of mistakes. But if it failed, how can it possibly have been
obvious? They said it was because of mistakes by the users.
Exactly.
Not mistakes in the creation of the product to employ in the method.
Mistakes by the dyer, the person to whom the patent is directed. If the dyer couldn't get it to work, how does that make the existence of the solution make it obvious to dye?
Maybe we have a semantical problem here. You're referring to the dyer as if it's the guy who stirs the vat. I would think in the case of a method for doing dyeing that the artisan is a dye method designer, not a guy who stirs a vat with a paddle.
No, Your Honor, that wasn't the testimony at trial. At trial, the testimony was that the dyer, the person skilled in the art, is the guy with the paddle. He's the guy that flips the switches.
Well, but there's got to be somebody above him who designed the whole process, who built the vats, who decided. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe the skill in the art was set far too low here.
There was conflicting expert testimony on what the skill in the art was, and the jury elected to believe the testimony of Dystar's expert. In the Fourth Circuit, when it's evident from a jury's verdict that the jury believed one expert over another, it's not the province of the appellate court to disturb that. I mean, I don't believe the standard was too low. We had a person testify about this.
Yeah, but the guy who's stirring the vat doesn't have any knowledge of the chemistry of leuco-indigo.
Correct.
And that's we all understand is the key to this patent, is the instability of leuco-indigo, and how do you surmount that? That's chemistry. That's not stirring vats.
Correct. But that's not the only key to this patent. The other key to the patent is having the aha moment of saying, well, let's try to just introduce this into the dye bath. And lo and behold, it worked. No one thought it would work. They didn't think.
But that wasn't the guy who stirred with the paddle. That was some bright chemist somewhere.
Well, that was the inventor, George Schnitzel.
Yeah, he doesn't have a paddle and stir dye, does he?
Actually, he does.
Well.
And his skin under his fingernails is blue.
Thank you.
We've given you a considerable extra time, Mr. Hino, so we have to call it to a halt. Mr. Jones, you have 3 minutes left of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to address a couple quick things, and one thing to your point, Judge Rader, let me read to you out of the Chamont patent 978. It says, and this is talking about a leuco-indigo solution, and at the end of the day, whether you produce leuco-indigo solutions by means of electrolysis or iron reduction or by catalytic hydrogenation, the chemical is the same. They are all unstable in the air. And this is what the 978 patent says. It is possible to preserve the indigo solution indefinitely in a closed vessel and consequently to place this solution on the market for use in dyeing. That was our evidence regarding this instability issue. Second issue, and Judge Rader, I don't know how you hit on this, but you must have read the transcript already because this was not in the appendix and in our briefs. But you're right, some errors started creeping into this, and there was a gigantic error made by their technical expert, Dr. Blackman. I asked him twice, and this is at pages in the trial transcript, pages 399, 402, 403, and page 405. I asked him, isn't the real question in this case not what the authors meant by the term solution, but how one of ordinary skill in the art in 1992 would have interpreted the word solution? Isn't that the real key? Answer, I don't think so, no. I asked him later on, and he said to the same question, I'm not entirely sure, I think I know what you're saying. It's difficult to make that judgment when I understand exactly what a solution is. And that was the error that crept in from their expert into the obviousness determination and what the term solution means. As far as putting it together, the 1936 manual, Your Honor, you mentioned the BIOS report. I think it's actually the 1936 manual for dyeing of cotton, which puts everything together. And I'll just read to you from appendix page A2935. When dyeing with, and there's a laundry list, including indigo solution, BASF 20%, containing the dye stuff in a reduced, and obviously that means leuco condition, and water-soluble state, the preparation of a stock vat is unnecessary. The 1936 manual is the piece of prior art that puts everything together. It says use this solution. And then, Your Honor, two other quick points. The sale by Mr. Bann, again, it's not prior art under U.S. patent law. That's not what we're saying. But he sold it to a dyer for use in dyeing cotton. And that's exactly what this patent is about. And finally, Your Honor, please keep in mind the ordinary skill in the art, whether it's the higher level which we propose or whether it's the level that they propose. Somebody reading solution believes it's a solution. Thank you.
All right. We thank both counsel. We'll take the appeal under advisement.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10:30.